Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My next guest is a force in the media and conservative politics today who has a new book. Andrew Breitbart runs a variety of websites, including the news and video aggregation sites, Breitbart.com and Breitbart.tv, and four politics and culture sites with the names BigGovernment.com, Big Hollywood, Big Journalism, and Big Peace, and coming soon, I understand, BigEducation.com. Formerly with the Drudge Report and the Huffington Post, maybe you've seen him as a guest on Bill Maher. He speaks frequently at Tea Party gatherings and is a biting critic of liberal bias as he sees it in the media. Breitbart is very powerful, getting a reported millions of views per day on his sites, and he has been at the center of various controversies in recent years, as you may know, including the Acorn Sting videos, which he first published, the Shirley Sherrod video, and his controversial hosting of parties for gay conservatives the last 2 years at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee conference held in D.C. And the gossip mongers tell us he's married to the daughter of actor Orson Bean. Andrew Breitbart's new book is called Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World. Andrew Breitbart, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thank you very much for having me.
That title could come from very opinionated people on the right or the left. Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World. It could be you or your friend Ariana. Is that a good starting point from either side for actually solving our nation's problems?
Well, the reason why I wrote it took me 6 months to write the book and 7 months to come up with the title. And the reason why I came up with the title is because I over the last 2 years, I've become probably the primary defender of the Tea Party against what seems to be a coordinated effort to frame the Tea Party as racist, sexist, homophobic, and all these terrible things. And, you know, when you're a conservative, especially when you're in Los Angeles, your motives are impugned. You know, if you're on the left, you're for the children, you're for the environment, you're against war. Well, that by default means that conservatives are against the children, against the environment, and that they're for war as a natural state. And I am trying to state in this title that we who disagree with the left are coming from, we may disagree with you on, you know, means, but we want to make the world a better place. And so I really am motivated by pure and good and decent motivations, and I don't like that the media so effectively portrays conservatives as being evil or out to hurt the environment or out to money grub and be greedy.
Your Wikipedia page says you grew up as a secular liberal Jew in upscale Brentwood in Los Angeles. You were a liberal in college. And then as a young man, you had a political epiphany during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. Is that how it happened?
In a nub, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. But I would say that I still am agnostic. I'm not a religious conservative, but I do respect social conservatives and religious conservatives. I just happen to be one of these anomalies out there as an agnostic. I remember the Clarence Thomas hearings. I had gone to the Iran-Contra hearings when I was in high school. I saw, I believe, George Shultz and Poindexter when they were being grilled, and I aspired to go there in high school, and I went to journalism summer school at American University, and I just liked political theater, and I came in to the Clarence Thomas hearings thinking, okay, let's take down this serial sexual harasser. And by the end of the event, I kept thinking, well, where's the accusation? What's the worst thing that they're even claiming that he did that's so bad? And when it was the pubic hair on the Coke can thing, I wanted to throw my shoe at the television set, and I didn't understand how the Ted Kennedy could sit in judgment of this man, given his history with women.
Because you didn't think that was so bad of Clarence Thomas, or you didn't believe it?
I said, if this is it, everybody was so serious at ABC, CBS, and NBC, like this is the most serious accusation in the world. Even if it were true, it seemed like a nothing sandwich. And when a year later my suspicions were confirmed that this was a show trial because he happened to be, you know, have the sin of being a conservative and a black who in all likelihood would vote against Roe versus Wade, that it was a setup, because less than a year later Bill Clinton, the Bill Clinton of sexual harassment fame, was set up as the standard bearer of the same Democratic Party that said, "I believe Anita," in every bumper sticker in my neighborhood. And I thought, there's something wrong here. I don't understand how Clarence Thomas can be pilloried while Bill Clinton can be protected on the same grounds of sexual harassment. And it acted as an epiphany for me that started me down a path of starting to challenge the mainstream media narrative.
You were inspired early on by the way Matt Drudge put his news aggregation site together. That was the mid-90s, 3 years before he really burst on the mainstream scene, breaking the Monica Lewinsky story. What was it about Drudge?
Well, you know, I was having a humble sandwich served to me years after college, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was working, I waited tables, I was a music editor for a local magazine. I was doing a whole bunch of things, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, realizing I really didn't like Hollywood. I didn't like the movies and television, wasn't passionate in it. And I got hooked on the internet for the first time in around 1994, 1995, and one of the first people that I met was Matt Drudge. And he came down to Orson's place, down on the Venice Canals, right across the street from the very friendly and shy, the late George Carlin. And Matt Drudge, for 4 hours, we discussed the media. And he discussed what he had started to do with this online newsletter, The Drudge Report. And as he putted away in his Hyundai to go back to his job at the CBS gift shop, where he was basically folding, designing women T-shirts, I looked at my then-girlfriend, who's now my wife, and I said, I think that guy's going to change media.
And you're right about working with Arianna Huffington while she was still a conservative, by the way. People forget that phase. But you also helped her launch Huffington Post as a liberal counterweight to Drudge. Why did you do that?
Because given my overall critique of the media, which is that it naturally leans to the left, that people in Manhattan and Los Angeles, my neighbors, I have an apartment in New York, that my neighbors who are involved in the media at cocktail parties and dinner parties are quite the advocates for liberal or leftist policies. And I thought, well, then conservatives need to get in the game. So I think that Drudge and Rush Limbaugh and Fox News represent a foray into the media to start the counterbalance. But I also so believe in free speech. I'm a Lenny Bruce guy. I'm a George Carlin guy. I'm against political correctness. I can't stand that Sarah Silverman's allowed to say whatever joke she wants because she's protected and that Chris Rock is protected. But a Sam Kinison or an Andrew Dice Clay are pilloried for basically saying the same type of jokes. And so I'm a free speech person, and I thought that the Huffington Post idea would prove my that thesis that I am a free speech person. I want there to be more voices in the media, not less.
Conservative media activist Andrew Breitbart, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World. And your book begins with your telling of the Acorn Sting operation. Why are you glad that Acorn is out of business?
When James and Hannah came to me with the videos, it was with a bow on it, basically. But they knew that ABC, CBS, and NBC wouldn't cover the story, that had Acorn not been the target and it was the NRA or the Catholic Church, I guarantee you Katie Couric would have owned this story. I guarantee you that Rolling Stone would have had Hannah and James on the front. And that HBO would have given them a series to continue to keep doing this. But I knew that because it represented the vaunted community organizing group that Barack Obama was associated with, and that people associated it with, quote-unquote, helping the poor, but not really looking at how great society, hooking people up to the government and dependency. I knew that this so went against the narrative that the mainstream media provides on groups like that the media wouldn't touch it. And so when Hannah and James came to me with, I said, of course you're coming to me because you know you're not going to get the mainstream media to do it. They thought that this was going to take down Acorn. I said, I think this is going to take down the mainstream media because it's going to show, as we do one video at a time, that the mainstream media is going to take Acorn's side and trying to defend the indefensible. And for the first three videos, they'd go to Acorn, take their side. Acorn would lie. They'd say there were no more videos. We'd do the second one. After the second one, they said they tried this in New York, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles and got kicked out, which set us up perfectly because we had the videos from New York where they said of the pimp and prostitute money to hide it from the government, bury it in the backyard in a tin. That was sort of the highlight of the New York one. And it showed that the mainstream media was providing cover for the group, and when the media could no longer defend Acorn, it exposed itself to the scrutiny that Congress defunded it. And I would say the best report on it in the mainstream media was about five videos in, when it was so damning beyond, you know, anybody's, you know, idea of what could possibly happen if a pimp and a prostitute walked in claiming that they were going to help them establish an underage sex slave operation for 14 and 15-year-old girls from El Salvador. It was John Stewart who did a masterful job of pointing out not just what was wrong on the tapes, but the media's trying to cover up for it.
On the other hand, the sting has subsequently come under great criticism, and with it, some of your credibility come under great criticism, though too late for Acorn.
I disagree with that. Yeah.
Because of the editing of the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So as your nemesis on the left, Media Matters, puts it, Jerry Brown, as California Attorney General, did a review of the sting and found that in the edited tapes, as they appeared on your site, the stinger, O'Keefe, was dressed as a 1970s Superfly pimp, making it more like Acorn was willing to do business with someone truly outrageous. But in his actual taped sessions with Acorn workers, he was dressed in a shirt and tie, presented himself as a law student, and said he planned to use the prostitution proceeds to run for Congress, and never claimed he was a pimp, according to that. And also, according to Brown, the release omitted instances where Acorn offices did not get pulled in at all, some of the ones you cited.
All those things are untrue, and provably so, and I'll stay on for as long as if you want to go down every single thing that Media Matters has said there and Jerry Brown has said there, it's all provably untrue. When Hannah and James came to me, I said, you're going to be held to a different standard. The mainstream media is going to try and take you down. And it didn't dawn on them the degree to which they would pursue them for destruction after the fact when it was such a clean bust. I said, we need to put the full context of your edited videos up there so people don't get the false impression that you're putting words or ideas into people's mouths by selectively editing things. And so we immediately put up the full transcripts of the entire Acorn videos, except for Philadelphia, which we are asking for permission from Acorn because they said they were going to sue because it's Hannah and James went into a two-party consent state. So we put up every transcript and every full audio. So I guarantee you this, they had everyone, Media Matters, Acorn, the mainstream media, had the full context, and there was no way to explain away the behavior to try and to deflect on us that James created a series of videos that included music, an intro sequence where he is dressed as an extravagant-looking pimp. But what you will see in those selectively edited ones, they don't distort the reality of what happened and what the accusations happened. And the straw man argument of him being dressed as an extravagant pimp versus a non-extravagant pimp is a pointless one. What does it matter if every Acorn office they were helping a person who was a Dockers wearing, khakis wearing pimp versus an extravagant one?
They so were people will disagree.
And to add to that, it's not true. If you look at seconds 18 through 22, you watch of the first video in Baltimore, you see James walking in khakis and an Oxford, and you see him exiting in a khakis and an Oxford in seconds 38 right. through 42.
So people will disagree about the context, but I want to go to what actually occurred as a result. Because to a lot of poor people here in New York, for example, Acorn was a lifeline, a very hands-on organization that helped them get affordable housing or government benefits that they were legally entitled to, and lobbied for government policies that would help poor people directly. Many people see that as a noble calling, saving the world one month of food stamps or housing vouchers at a time. In the bigger scheme of things, that's what you helped to kill from their point of view. Mm-hmm. Do you object to the whole enterprise?
Well, they were under so much hardcore scrutiny from everyone. The reports on things that had happened at Acorn, such as Wade Rathke's brother, Dale, you know, siphoning millions of dollars from it, you know, money that should have helped the poor, but he used it for his own benefit, yet they never fired this guy. And even, you know, the reason why Bertha Lewis had to take over was because there were internal people from Acorn, I believe they were called the Acorn Nine, people like Anita Moncrief, who were whistleblowers, saying that Acorn has a fine-sounding mission, but the way that it was run, the way that money was wasted, the way that money was spent, was not helping the very people that it was supposed to help, that it was being used as an arm of the Democratic Party to help get Democrats elected. And I confronted a group of Acorn people who were protesting once, and I asked Bon Hurd, who has written for the Los Angeles Times on behalf of Acorn. She stated on tape that Acorn gets federal money, and that but its sole job is to try and help get Democrats elected to office. I resent that the group tries to hide its purpose, gets federal funding or received federal funding, claiming that it was helping the poor, but was used to help the Democratic Party to get leftists elected.
There was also the edited Shirley Sherrod video first published on your site, which seemed to show the Agriculture Department officials saying she discriminated against white people in her work when she was really making the opposite point. You later posted the full video, and Sherrod was vindicated. Do you have regrets about that incident?
Well, I regret that the media framed it in an unfair way, and I'm on a media tour right now where, interestingly, I find myself explaining the story in greater detail. Nobody wanted to hear the context of the story when they were talking about context back in July of last year. I had a 1,400-word piece that had these words: eventually her basic humanity informs her to help the white farmer. And the 2-plus-minute video clip that was put on my website was along with another video that nobody paid attention to. And in it, her narrative, her redemptive arc, where she says, "But then I realized it's not about black versus white. It's about rich versus poor." That was, in essence, her argument, that she realized from that story that it wasn't about black versus white, it was rich versus poor. The only person to defend me in this, ironically, on television to Howard Dean and Joan Walsh of Salon, they looked at him in abject horror that he actually went online and looked at my video and my story, and he said, "But Breitbart kept in the redemptive part." What ended up happening is that Glenn Beck, on his radio show, ended up taking the 2-plus-minute thing, which was my argument against the NAACP, which was framing the Tea Party as racist, by saying that members of its Tea Party audience were racist. I said those that live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And I have video of your group laughing at a lady talking about how she stuck it to the white farmer. And I stand by that point today, because the NAACP apologized for the behavior of the audience the day that it happened. Glenn Beck did not see that context. And on his radio show, he cut it into little 15-second, 10-second sound bites where he focused on Shirley Sherrod and what she was saying, and was ignored the complete NAACP versus
so
Tea Party narrative.
Your original point was to show the members of the audience reacting positively, or some members of the audience reacting positively to that part of the story in which she said she was discriminating against the white farmer before she gave the end of the story.
Yes, the week before, Ben Jealous of the NAACP had been on TV on ABC, CBS, and NBC attacking the Tea Party as racist, saying that the NAACP was condemning the Tea Party for racist elements within. And I went on a radio show the Thursday before the Monday that we put the two videos out there and the story, and I said, Ben Jealous, you're trying to divide this country on the racial schism. The country can ill afford for you to be fomenting this type of racial animus, you know, during a summer in which everybody is suffering. So that was the context. And Shirley Sherrod on day one said she blamed the NAACP for this because they got into a fight with the Tea Party. The NAACP apologized and recognized that the audience's reaction was wrong. It was only when the president found himself in peril, because he fired her even after she said, I helped the white farmer, and the president and Tom Vilsack said, we don't care. They kept her fired. They stood by it, even though she said she had the redemptive moment. And so the fact that the White House fired her without due process, they certainly needed to distract attention from their mistake when she even told them she helped the white farmer. Wait, and my piece said it.
We have 2 minutes left. We're way over time already. But two things real quick. Give me quick answers on your hosting of gay conservative parties at CPAC the last 2 years. This year it broke out as more of a controversy. Does this mean you're a fiscal conservative but not a social conservative?
That's not my point. I'm not trying to make a point on gay marriage or not. I can't stand how the debate is delineated at the national level as if you're against gay marriage, you're a hater. I know gay people who are for, who are against gay marriage, and I know straight people who are for it. My big thing is I have a ton of gay conservative friends who have it. If I have it bad as a conservative in Hollywood, imagine what it's like to be conservative in the gay community.
And you think there's a significant gay conservative vote to get out there?
Absolutely. That are hardcore fiscal conservatives, and I want to represent the part of the big tent that says I could care less what your sexual orientation are. Some of my best friends are gay, and I was able to meet one of my great heroes on the Bill Maher show, John Waters, 2 weeks ago.
He was great on this show 2 weeks ago, too.
Oh, he's God.
And last thing, this is the media world that we live in today, these controversies that we've been discussing, increasingly decentralized, lots of opinionated, agenda-driven citizen journalism, James O'Keefe posing as a pimp here, someone else posing as David Koch, fooling Scott Walker there, the Yes Men punking AP as if they were General Electric, volunteering to pay more taxes. Does journalism as trickster stunt inform or make a mockery?
I think it does both, but I think that the question seems to be asked when Hannah and James does it, but not when Scott Walker. I think this has been a very fair interview, and the way that you brought in the Yes Men and the guy from the Buffalo Beast guy speaks to your fairness in that question. I grew up with Abbie Hoffman as an idol. I still think he's one of the funniest guys in the world, and Hunter Thompson and the Merry Pranksters. I watch as Dateline dresses up as in Muslim garb to go to NASCAR rallies to try to get middle Americans in NASCAR Nation to say terrible things to people dressed in Muslim garb. They failed at it. As long as the mainstream media tells me that Hunter Thompson deserves his own wing of the J School, and that that it's okay when Dateline does it and when 60 Minutes does it, I'm not going to be here to criticize it when James O'Keefe or the liberal from the Buffalo Beast did it up in with Scott Walker. I certainly didn't criticize him for doing it. And I happen to be a huge fan of Borat, Ali G, and Bruno.
Andrew Breitbart's new book is called Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, advice for new college graduates on setting up your finances for your first year as an actual grown-up. Stay with us.